of interviews have you been doing?
Radio mostly. Radio mostly, which I like.
Where have you been?
We just were at RKO, and I think we were at WBAI, and before that was a bookstore signing, or somewhere in there was a bookstore signing.
Dr. Gilgross?
No.
At RKO?
No, it was Barbara Malkin, if I get her name right, Barbara.
Well, that's all right. I'm not familiar with her name, but Gil, if you
She used to be a WRVR. Uh-huh. I recognized maybe 4 years ago, I did an interview with her when she was there. But Gil, I think her name is different.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't. I think Gil has been on the political beat. He and I used to do a lot of literary interviews here when he was working here as a midday anchor person. And so we did together people like John Cheever and John Gardner, a lot of dead people, quite a few others, because we both had a literary interest, and so we did a lot of joint interviews.
I just got John Gardner's book of essays. I just picked it up in passing for about 2 seconds, so I can't even tell you.
Is that the new one on the writing?
Yeah. Just looked
that had been a book that he had put together in mimeograph form, I understand, that he had used as a basis for his creative writing course at the State University of New York at Binghamton. So this had been passed around for a long time. And matter of fact, there was a cover article on the New York Times magazine about Gardner a couple of years ago, and it had mentioned then that that this was going to become a new book, and when he was in, he denied it. He said, no, it was something we talked about, but it really wasn't in the right form to be a book. But somehow they...
Well, like Nabokov's lectures.
They got it together somehow.
Yeah.
And I'd like to go back, if you don't mind, and chat for a few minutes about your origins. Now, I know that you were born and raised in Detroit, and I imagine some of that early activity manifested itself in Braided Lives to a degree. Tell me about your childhood and what it was like growing up in Detroit.
I grew up in a working class neighborhood in Detroit where a lot of people worked in the factories. It was a neighborhood that was segregated by blocks, black or white by blocks. I remember the Detroit race riots. They were terrifying. The experience in our neighborhood, they consisted of whites coming in and beating up blacks in our neighborhood. I remember that.
Came that close?
Yeah. That's actually one of my earliest memories. I think it is of a lot of people who grew up in Detroit. And I know Phil Levine has some very moving poems about that. That was 1943. Maybe that's what I think of because I'm doing a lot of research on World War II now, which is, of course, some of my earliest memories.
Your war, in a way.
Yeah.
Our childhood war that
was
we remember.
Formed by it, right.
I remember almost fondly. I mean, it's terrible to think of a war that you remember fondly, but I remember the little an army truck with the pedals that I used to drive around. And
playing commando with the boys. I remember that. That was one of the things. Instead of cops and robbers, we played commandos.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in Detroit is a very good place for a writer to grow up because the difference between the way things are supposed to be and the way they are really does come and get you. You know, you see a lot of contradictions, you see a lot of violence, and you see a lot of poverty, and you see a lot of people trying to achieve social mobility and either getting, you know, crawling up in class or being pushed back down again very frequently. You see a lot of class slippage. You see a lot of people of different ethnic origins and so forth, sometimes bashing each other's heads in, sometimes managing to get on together. It's a good place for a writer to come from.
Do you ever get back?
When my parents still lived there, I used to go back very frequently. Not so often now. I don't have any relatives left there. And if I go in, it's generally because someone brings me in for a reading or something. I like to go there. I like very much to go there. I don't go, you know, regularly anymore because I don't have the family.
March Piercy, you said you liked to play commando with the boys when you were growing up, but did you ever have any literary pretensions at that early age?
Until I had rheumatic fever, I don't even think I had any interest in school. I think I was a below average or simply average student until I had rheumatic fever. I learned the glories of books because I couldn't do anything else for a while. I think a lot of writers, I had that little sickly period after a very vigorous early childhood and again in late adolescence when I was in a gang. In between, I was a new sort of very pale, blue little child with a weak heart who would, you know, get out of breath picking up a pencil, so I read a great deal.
Walter Tevis had the same experience with a heart condition to the degree that when his parents moved from San Francisco to Kentucky, he was left behind and spent most of his time, because he was frail, reading books.
Well, that's what I did in that mid-childhood era, and I think it taught me that there's a different world there, that there were all these horizons that were quite different from what I could see. There's a certain aesthetic in Detroit. I mean, the landscape is very lush, but the human surroundings in working-class neighborhoods are very mean. So there's a sort of gritty contrast between the beauty of nature, which sort of bursts out of everything. If you leave a vacant lot alone, it turns into a jungle. There's this green, ferocious, beautiful, bountiful nature sort of struggling to burst through everything. And then there's this very, really rather flat, mean city all around you that's really rather dirty and drab where I grew up. So there's this tremendous contrast between that and then the beauty in the books of this world that existed all sorts of other places which you could imagine about and escape to in books.
Orange Piercy, you got a little older. You went away to college, University of Michigan.
Right. I was the first person in my family to go to college. I got a scholarship.
What was college like for you? What did you study?
Everything I could lay my hands on. I was an English major, but I had minors in anthropology, zoology, various Romance languages, I mean, all sorts of philosophy. I wanted to learn everything. Very much like Jill in Braided Lives. I was omnivorously curious. I loved college. It was an unpleasant experience to be a poor student. That is, I was a very good student as far as classes and exams and things, but I had no money, and I was working my way through, and so that was very difficult. I sort of experienced class snobbery for the first time. Where I'd grown up, everybody was working class, and I didn't know. We thought we were middle class because we owned our own little house. It was a very tiny house, and we're making payments on our own car, so we felt quite middle class. And
You graduated what year?
From college?
Mm-hmm.
57. And then I went to Northwestern, took my MA, and then I decided to get out of college. It was the first security I'd ever known financially. And I sort of realized that I was moving. I would be a poet if I stayed in college, but the kind of poet I would have been is very different from the kind I became. I think I would have been a very traditional academic poet. I don't think I would have been a novelist. Because I was losing my sense of who I was and where I came from. And so I left college with my MA and went down to the south side of Chicago. And next 4 years I had all sorts of part-time jobs, and I lived very grubbily. And I sought to be able to do what I could imagine but not do in fiction and poetry. I sort of spent 4 years putting myself to school. I couldn't find the kind of writing I wanted to do, not being done. There were no political novels by women being written in the United States that I could find. There was nothing that spoke to the world as I knew it. When people who were like myself appeared in novels, they tended to be either earth mothers or buffoons or represent, you know, death or nature or something. So that wasn't too interesting. And I wanted to, in poetry, return to the spoken voice more. And at that time, poetry had become quite artificial. People were writing lots of sestinas and sonnet sequences about paintings they'd seen on their Fulbright scholarships in the Uffizi Museum or something. And it was just, you know, it had gotten a little deteriorated, and I wanted to do something else, and so I had to learn how to do it.
Isn't it odd that in some respects you became an activist literarily, and yet you still are a product of the 1950s in terms of education, as am I, a time when people didn't tend to think very much about the realities of life, and indeed much of the activism that developed in this country happened well after the 50s into the 60s and 70s.
Well, I got to have two adolescences, you know. I got to have one when I was in college at the normal time, and I got to have another one in the 60s. I grew up in the 60s all over again. I was in SDS, and I was in, I did do chapter traveling, and I was involved with things on campuses, but I was always interested in off-campus organizing, so, I mean, it wasn't like really going to school twice. But, yeah, I got to grow up again then. So I've had two adolescences, one in the 50s and one in the 60s.
I missed my second one. Maybe
the second one was more
now.
Fun than the first one. I don't think it's much fun to be an adolescent now. I have a lot of feeling for the kids and how hard it is. That's part of what the high cost of living was about.
It's tougher to be an adolescent now for a variety of reasons. Well, one, I think, is a pervasive drug culture, which makes it more difficult for adolescents to adjust to life.
There was a lot of drugs when I was in school too, in not college then. There were very few drugs in college, just alcohol, which was bad enough. Because there was that 50s drinking culture that to be a writer you should drink, and if possible be drunk. There was all that romanticism around alcohol then, and I think that destroyed lots of writers. I sort of went into that in college, and I thought it was very romantic to be drunk and all that, and then I finally realized this made me feel ghastly and I didn't write very well, so I sort of lost interest in that. But there was a street drug culture when I was growing up, and it terrified me. I think I lost my first friend to heroin when I was 15. She was on the streets, and heroin in those days was very strong. So I was terrified of drugs. I mean, to me, it represented how I would end up on the streets. I would end up stuck there. You know, it was like sticky paper. You'd be a fly caught in it, and you wouldn't get out.
You got out of, you said Northwestern?
Yeah.
You got out of Northwestern. You had your master's degree.
Yeah.
What did you do then?
I did all kinds of part-time jobs. I realized that I needed a lot of time to learn to write, and so I was going to have to settle for a sort of poverty-level existence in the kind of part-time work that you do. I did all sorts of part-time jobs for the next... 8 years or so. Everything from teaching in college part-time, those little instructor jobs you get, to working as secretary part-time. I was telephone operator. I did coding. I was an artist model. Did all those things. Used to work for figure painters.
Tell me about your first book. What was that, and how did it come about?
Well, the first book I wrote when I was between 15 and 17, and I burned it a few years ago when I realized if I dropped dead suddenly, someone might actually read it. The first published one is probably what you mean, which was my seventh novel.
Your seventh novel?
Yes, it was my seventh novel.
You mean you'd had that in the drawer all that time?
No, it got published when I wrote it, but I mean I'd written six before that.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I see. So you had six false starts, in effect.
Well, they weren't false starts. There's one of them in particular that should have been published. One of them was lost in the mail. I mean, it's a long story. Another one was lost in a flood. I mean, I was madly persistent.
You didn't have copies?
You have to really understand. No, not of those two. After that, I took carbons on everything. For years, I would take carbons on everything but, you know, grocery lists. I'm terribly compulsive now about copies, copy out of the house, a copy kept in somebody else's house, a copy kept here, a copy kept there. I squirrel copies away. I'm obsessive that way. But I was very, very driven to write. If I could have been discouraged, I would have been, because it took me a very long time to begin to get published. My poetry was published in little magazines for years, but to get a book, and the world had to change before I could publish a novel.
The world had to change?
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I would always get the same things. I always had agents because they recognized the talent. I'd won contests early and so forth. But they would always say, I can identify with these people. If these people exist, I don't want to read about them. And the world had to change until these people became most people, and then they could be written about. I was writing, you know, political novels when you weren't supposed to be at all. And it was very repellent to people for a long time.
All right, tell me about novel number seven.
That was going down fast. That was the novel that came out, really, a lot of my experiences in Chicago. It was about urban renewal. It was about the beginnings of Black Power. It was about the, you know, a little about the civil rights movement and a lot about real estate manipulations in large cities, as I've returned to, of course, in Fly Away Home.
I was going to say, after back all, to urban renewal.
the arson this time. But yeah, I've remained interested in that fiefdom of real estate interests that control cities, so that changes so much the face of our cities.
What kind of reception did novel number 7 have?
Number one. It came out, well, the editor who bought it retired before it was published, and I think the office boy ended up being my editor, and it came out to a great silence. Though it's in print nowadays. All my novels are now in print. It's very nice. It came back into print about 4 years ago in paperback. I actually meet people who've read it now. But it came out very quietly.
And most first novels do.
Yes.
It's not unusual.
No.
Once in a while, some hit with a bombshell, like From Here to Eternity or Lie Down in Darkness. But generally, writers smooth their craft to a degree, and they develop, and each succeeding novel, when the writer has talent, becomes better and better.
The second novel got a lot of attention. It had a terrible time getting published. It was rejected by about 25, and I think in those days there were a lot more publishers to line up to reject it, and they did. But when it came out, it got stunning reviews, and it was the first novel of mine that did well and got a lot of attention. That was Dance the Eagle to Sleep. It was a sort of speculative fiction treatment of the New Left.
How does it feel being rejected by publishers?
Well, it always feels dreadful. Because they always, you know, they always sort of invent literary reasons. I mean, the honest rejection slips would nowadays say, I read this novel with pleasure, but I can't get the sales staff to sell it. Therefore, I'm not about to put my job on the line for you. Bye bye. Nobody ever says that. They always say, yeah, well, this is a remarkable novel. We feel it doesn't quite, you know, cohere, and the characters aren't quite convincing. There's always literary reasons given for rejecting novels, which I think has become over the years more and more hypocritical, because it's more and more you're dealing with a bottom line situation in which they don't know how to sell serious fiction anyhow, and they don't, you know, they won't say this is very good, but we can't persuade the sales staff to move it.
Marge Piercy, you've talked about some of these things too. Maybe you could go into a little more detail for me about the themes that you have been approaching over the years. You mentioned the New Left. We mentioned the real estate interest and urban renewal and this sort of thing.
The Small Changes was the first of my novels that was, I think, consciously a feminist novel, and consciously so perceived. It's also, there was a period of time when I was very ill, between Dance the Eagle, The Sleep, and Small Changes. We really lived as if my body were an infinitely renewable resource. I was an organizer, and I could believed I could work all day, dance all night, eat garbage, and I smoked then, and I really used myself like this, you know, infinitely renewable resource, and then I had a total collapse. Ever since then, I'm like, you know, someone who's been an alcoholic, I'm an ex-lung patient, and so I live carefully. I had to learn how to live all over again. And learning to live, I learned to write better. And there was this period in between when I also went back and read the Victorians very consciously. And I had this conversion experience about the Victorians, and that there was something they had been doing in fiction which had gotten lost. I think in some ways it's like John Gardner's, which is why I have that interest in him, because I think he had similar notions, though from a very different political perspective, on the moral center of the novel, and that the novel is a creation of moral and ethical choice, and that it has to do with his coming to consciousness in people, and I consciously went back and studied then the Victorian novelists and decided to incorporate some of those virtues in my writing, and I think my writing ever since has had certain of those, that kind of concern, consciously, to be making, showing what happens when people make choices through time, to being relate very consciously to people's moral and ethical choices in their lives.
I think that is apparent in Fly Away Home. Your heroine, however, does not strike me as a feminist.
And she's not.
And she's not, right. And you talked about your consciously feminist novels of the past, and this seems to be somewhat of a departure.
No, when I wrote Vita, I was very interested, again, in two sisters, one of whom became a feminist, but I was interested in Vita, who hadn't, had made choices which led her into the sort of, what we in the women's room always called the male left, hadn't identified as a feminist. And I was very interested about what made one sister make one choice and one sister make the other choice. And Dari is a woman, like a lot of women whom I meet, who wants for her daughters a different life than she's had for herself. What she wants for them is a lot more autonomy than she's had. Constantly I meet women who will say, well, yes, I believe in equal pay for equal work. Yes, of course I work. Yes, I want my daughters to have lives in which they have a lot of choices and a lot of autonomy. But no, I'm not a feminist. Because feminist is a bad word. And they're saying is, I'm not a bad woman. But I'm a woman and I have rights and I want them. Because feminist has become a dirty word. And Dari is not at all consciously a feminist, beginning or the end of the book, but she comes into an activeness in her own life. She grows up.
She does grow up, but boy, she certainly started out as a very naive woman, not knowing what her husband is doing. And
that may seem naive to you. I wonder if you would walk into any businessman's convention and interview their wives about what they do on the job, what kind of answers you'd get. I think that an awful lot... Now, working class women generally don't have the choice to be naive about money, how much there is, you know, what's going on with it. But middle class women often do. It's like one of the last areas of shame and modesty, is you don't inquire too closely into the family finances. The man often manages it. And Daria is a woman who has preferred to be innocent about many things in her life, as her sister says to her. She doesn't want to know the unpleasant things. And she doesn't want to know the things that she regards as her husband's area of expertise. It's sort of those traditional sex role divisions. She learns about money because she has to, because it's being taken away from her. In common with most women who are divorced, she experiences a class drop. And if she accepts his estimates of their financial situation, she's going to experience an awful class drop. So she has to begin to understand where the money comes from, where it goes, and what's happening to it.
What brought you east?
When?
I've shifted gears a little bit here. What brought you from the Midwest? Now you're living...
I'd been in France for a while, and I'd come to New York once. I mean, I'd wandered around a lot, and I was... when I left Chicago, I, after all, lived mostly in the Midwest, except for those other times in New York and in France. I'd been mostly in the Midwest for the first 25 years of my life or so, and I really was very interested to live other places. And so I lived in Boston for a while, and then I lived in San Francisco for a while, and then I came back to Boston and then up to New York. And usually there were reasons for moving that are, you know, not very interesting in retrospect, but I was always curious to live different places. I don't think I ever put down roots until 12 years ago when I moved to Wellfleet on Cape Cod. And then I fell passionately in love with the land, and I really dug in there.
Did you bump into Henry Morgan?
No, I never have.
You used to live there?
In Truro, I think, but I've never run into him.
Well, We're about to lose our studio time, but I have a couple of more questions I want to ask you, and I would like to focus on the way you perform as a writer and how you approach it. And Wellfleet, how do you have your working space set up?
There's an upstairs computer and a downstairs computer, and there are three of us using it. My secretary uses it some, and my husband, Ira Wood, who's a writer, also works, so there's three of us splitting it. The downstairs one, they're for sort of for different purposes. I mostly work upstairs and then come downstairs to print because I have all my research materials around me there, and he mostly works downstairs and then comes upstairs when I'm printing downstairs, and we move around. But
what's it like having two writers in the same house?
It's actually rather fine most of the time. When we had only one computer, it's the only time we ever ran into difficulty about it because we're always leaning on each other. Are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? Can I get in? Can I get in?
Do you read each other's copy?
Oh, yes.
And
oh, he's my hardest critic. He's very good.
Well, what's it like being criticized by your husband?
Well,
you keep aloof?
We've worked together. We've wrote a play together, you know. That's before we were ever married or involved, we wrote a play together. So we got to know each other as writers.
Before you were married?
Oh, yes.
Well, that's different. Once you're married, your whole relationship changes.
I don't know. I think his relationship to the land changed when we got married, but I don't think our relationship really changed. We've been together for a while.
But what if he says, Marge, this is the dumbest line you've ever written?
Well, I look at it and see. Sometimes I agree with him, sometimes I don't. I really cut the umbilical cord. I may sulk about something for a while, and we all sulk at times I can sulk. He told me I looked too fat in a dress 2 nights ago, and I sulked for half an hour. I mean, you know, you sulk about things, but basically with my work, I do cut the umbilical cord, and I it isn't me. I know the work is it. And for me, that's a very important distinction. And to make a beautiful artifact and a true artifact, you have to know it's not you. It's not your baby. It's not your soul. It's it. And you have to make it as well as you can. And you have to be willing to, you know, to suffer the pain of revision and change and alteration and taking out the things that sounded the best. And very frequently, the lines you take out are the ones that when you wrote, you thought, "Ew, I'm clever."
That's the first time I've heard a writer say something like, my writing is not my baby, because most writers do consider their writing their baby.
Well, in the sense that it's my progeny, it is. But in the sense that it is not, I think when I said that, the image I had was of a baby inside. And also the fact that you let go and it belongs to other people. You learn very much that your work, once you've finished it and it's published, it belongs to other people and not to you. They do with it what they please. Other people relate to my work very strongly, and what they see in it, it's not always what I thought I was putting there. But I've learned that that's legitimate, and that there is that kind of letting go that you have to go through, and that your work really does belong to other people once you've finished it.
What discipline do you carve for yourself as you write?
I work every day that I'm home. I love to write. To me, it's bliss. It's the escape from the self. It's the entrance to that tower of concentration and light where you're completely lined up. And I love working.
Well, two writers living at home. Who does the cooking and the chores around the house?
We split them up. I mean, what do people do? What, if you both worked in a factory, what would you do? I mean, the same work has to be done. We grow a lot of our own fruit and vegetables, especially a lot of the vegetables. And we do a lot of outdoor things.
Do you like working on Cape Cod in the winter where there is more solitude?
There isn't more solitude. That's, you have this, in a sense, everybody probably has the same number of intimate friends no matter where they live. And what it basically means is that I can divorce myself to a certain extent from interruptions during part of my day, at any rate, better than I can in a city. But once the working day is over, the number of people you deal with is probably about the same. I mean, whether there's 2,000 people in town like there is in the winter or 22,000 as there is in the summer, the number of people you're going to eat supper with any given night tends to be about the same.
Well, Fly Away Home is now in the bookstores. It's been in the bookstores for quite a while. You finished it quite a while ago. Are you between books, or have you already launched a new project?
I'm never between books. Well, for one thing, working in more than one genre, I'm all the time writing poems. I'm all the time traveling and saying the poems. I mean, I perform all the time. Too much, I suppose, but I hate the traveling, but I love the performing. Oh, I'm working on my next book of poetry, which I'll probably finish this summer. And I've started the next novel, I always have. I mean, this is a long one, and it's very complicated, so... It's hard right now because I'm doing publicity on this one. It's interrupted, and it's sort of obsessional to get back to it.
Well, perhaps you'll be back in New York after your volume of poetry comes out. Maybe you'll come back and talk to me.
I'd love that.
Thank you very much for coming. It was a pleasure talking to you.